Hideous Earthlings. I am Zarvox. Carolyn and Joe asked me to be your special guest host for episode 186 of the Carolyn and Joe Show. This week I bring to you audio from Comics in the District, a discussion with local creators. This panel took place at the DC Jewish Community Center on Sunday, July 8, 2012. Moderated by Mike Rode, the co-author of Comics Research Bibliography. Panelists include Carolyn Bilevsky, the creator of the comic strip Curls, Steve Conley, the writer and artist of Bloop, Evan Keeley, an illustrator, designer and comic book artist, Andrew Cohen, a small press comic book creator, and Matt Dembicki, editor of District Comics, an unconventional history of Washington, D.C. Well, I'm off to the mothership. See you in the future. Now, enjoy the show, bloody humans.
Hi, my name is Mike Rohde. I moderate a comics blog here
in
Washington.
I'm sorry, my bad.
That's quite all right. Called Comics DC. And these are a bunch of local cartoonists who have experiences, hopefully nothing at all, like Siegel and Shuster's. Generally speaking, they don't work in the same type of field anymore either. The internet has changed a lot of things, as did underground comics. Andy's t-shirt is Robert Crumb, right?
Right.
So, starting in the 1960s, it became possible to publish comics yourself. You didn't necessarily have to rely on former pornographers based in New York City. Although Crumb published his own pornography, so maybe it's something about the medium. But anyway, so taking it from my immediate right, Matt Dembicki here tends to write graphic novels, longer format things, although sometimes they start out as comic books. Karen Bilevsky does a webcomic, which is a traditional comic strip type thing, three panels that appears two or three times a week. Two times a week. Steve Conley's done a little bit of everything. He's done comic books, web comics, a political comic strip on the web. Andrew, just a jack of all trades, right? You do mini comics, and you've done a longer format work with Matt about historic Washington site. And Evan Keeling, another jack of all trades. He's worked on a little bit of everything, and with Matt, is doing a book that appears next week about a great white shark. And most of the people up here are with a group called DC Conspiracy as well, which is just a local group of creators that publish various anthologies together and have also done a newspaper for five issues called Magic Bullet, which is pretty neat and is distributed freely in the area. So I think maybe everybody can talk a little bit about their work. Just we'll go in order. And then we'll start seeing if anybody has any questions or wants to ask about how things are so very different in some ways from what we saw on the plane, in some ways not as different. So Matt, why don't you talk about a couple of your, since you've got three projects coming out this year, why don't you dive right in?
Probably the biggest one is in a comics anthology called District Comics, an unconventional history of Washington, D.C. And that'll be coming out in September. And the stories, there's I think about 25 stories in the book, and it covers the span, the historical, the history of Washington, D.C., but all the stories are a bit unconventional. So the first story is actually about the first newspaper in Washington, D.C., and then we have a couple stories about the Civil War, the War of 1812, you know, the attempted assassination of President Truman, all the way through the inauguration of President Obama. But all the stories have a unique slant to it. They all have a unique narrative. For example, the story about Obama is told from the perspective of a police officer who designed the inaugural badges for the police department. And another example is we have a story about the funeral of JFK, and that's told from the perspective of the bugler who botched up one of the notes, and it's his story about how that all came about. And all the stories, these are all authentic stories, and whenever we could, we reached out to original sources. For example, the bugler story, we actually, he's no longer alive, but we reached out to his family, we interviewed his family, we looked at some of the letters he wrote and the letters he received. So we tried to give historical context of DC in a different kind of perspective.
So notwithstanding the Frederick Wortham that we saw, comics are for kids these days, and the audience for this is hopefully school children as well as people that like their stories about history, but I think generally speaking, you're hoping to reach a school children audience as well?
Yeah, I would say so. Historical events you might have heard of, but maybe it's told from a personal perspective that gives a little bit a different viewpoint of it. Mm-hmm. And then the other project I just want to mention, so we talk about local creations, is a district Magic Bullet, which our next issue will be coming out in September, and I think all the creators in Magic Bullet are going to be local creators. Everyone has one page, tabloid size. I actually have a copy of the current issue. And it's free, and it's kind of got that kind of almost San Francisco underground feel to it. And so we have some political cartoons in here. We have some cartoons that are just fun to do and fun to look at. The next one, actually, we're going to have a theme for the first time. It's going to be called End of the World. And since the Mayan calendar supposedly foresees the end of the world in December, we figured we better do all the comics we can before the end of the world. But, you know, we leave it up to the creators to decide what end of the world means, if it's the apocalypse or if it's something more personal. So look for that out whenever we can distribute it, and it's free.
Okay, and then the third project is a book called Shock, which is about a great white shark. And I think that'll appeal to a younger audience as well, because it's not Jaws, it's a more natural history type thing. So I'm looking forward to that. So Carolyn produces Curls twice a week. Can you tell us about Curls?
Sure. Curls is a webcomic, and it can be found online at curls-studio.com. And it's about a girl and a slice of toast, and then she has some animal friends like a turtle and a penguin, and also a Siamese fighting fish, who is the water weight champion of the world. And basically, we have like a lot of fun with their adventures, and we can go anywhere with anything. We've gone on fishing expeditions, and we've made a brain that can be able to print out your thoughts. Just anything is out there. Anything is possible with Curls, and it's really exciting to be publishing that on the internet, and it's accessible for everybody to read. You can even go back in the archives and catch up on everything. So that's really exciting project. I'm also on the District Comics with Matt, that's coming out in September. Magic Bullet as well. A lot of the local creators contribute to that newspaper. And what else? I know that there's another thing, Team Cul-de-Sac. Richard Thompson does a comic strip called Cul-de-Sac. You might be able to, it's right there, the book. And all the proceeds go to Parkinson's research. So actually, I think Matt's in it too. Steve's in it.
Yeah.
So a lot of the local artists are in there. We actually, this Wednesday, there's going to be a book signing at Politics and Prose if you're interested to go to that.
It's 7 p.m. in the evening.
7 p.m.
Should be about 12 cartoonists there.
So that should be really exciting. And it definitely goes to a good cause. And I have a lot of projects coming down the pike as well. But my main concentration is doing Curls. And then I do also do three other comic books with Joe Carveo. They are Kid Roxy, Black Magic Tales, and The Leggettes.
So again, self-published, she's not beholden to DC Comics at the moment. Whether or not she'd sell it to DC Comics, maybe we'll get into that later. So Steve, your current one is Bloop, right?
Yep, Bloop's a story, but actually I brought visual aids. I didn't quite know how it was gonna be set up, but I got some pages from it. But it's a web comic. I mean, I can imagine what Sequel and Schuster would have had if they had internet access back in the day, instead of, you know, just reaching millions, instead of ever being just cooped up. I mean, well, you're still cooped up, but you actually get to share your stuff with everybody. Some pages from, what's about a space monkey. The pages go online, and then we post a new page each week. And so it's free for people to read. And in September, there'll be a collection of it. We're hoping to print a nice big collection. I say we, it's just me. I don't know why I say we. But I brought these if anyone wants to take a look at some point later on. But it's online at bloopstree.com. I've done some traditional comics work. Like, I've actually done work for DC Comics, who's the, if anyone remembers, the Superman publisher. I was totally inspired by all the superheroes that came following Superman. I mean, that's what got me into comics. That's where I started. And I don't really have the drive to do anything in that genre, in the belong underwear genre, but but you know, it got me here, so you know, big debt. That's all.
As Mike mentioned, I kind of do mostly sort of mini comics, just kind of small sort of pamphlet sized comics, and I guess they're kind of on a variety of kind of styles. The one I'm working on now is called Dr. W, and is sort of about sort of a children's kind of character. It's just W, but it's kind of sort of playfully formal with kind of going in and out of the panels. I'm also doing I did a strip called Porter Black, which is about a U.S. attorney at the Justice Department, and that's more of kind of the web comic sort of style, kind of three panels across that I've been kind of serializing on the web. And then I guess the other project I'm kind of working on now is sort of more of a traditional comic book size, but it's about bare knuckle fighting in the 1850s New York. And then I have a story as well in District Comics about James Hampton and the kind of, I guess essentially like the church he built out of tin foil, and it's now in the Smithsonian. So it's sort of an idiosyncratic kind of DC story.
The Smithsonian Museum of American Art.
Right, and the folk art exhibit.
Yeah. Andrew is also, I believe, the person who's pulling together the current Magic Bullet, right?
No, that'll be Matt.
Matt, okay, but you ran the Kickstarter campaign?
Right.
Yeah, okay. One of the ways to raise money nowadays is crowdsourcing and just asking people online to subscribe to your publication before it exists. So I was getting a lot of emails from Andrew for the past couple months.
That was pretty annoying.
It was entertaining watching the process go on. And Evan?
Yeah. I also do a lot of, like as Andrew said, I do a lot of different sort of projects. I don't have a single project. The biggest thing I did currently was I colored Shock, which is Matt's Great White comic. And so I did a lot of time doing that. I did a brief stint on District Comics, which Matt was talking about, where I did some emergency coloring on a story. I've contributed to Magic Bullet throughout the whole run of it, doing a World War II female fighting ace strip. Because when they said newspaper comic, the first thing I wanted to do was an adventure comic, and I roped somebody into writing it for me. And so I've been doing that. That's like my most stable thing. Right now I'm beginning research and interviewing for a graphic novel I hope to do about the DC punk scene in the 90s and the stuff that came out of that. And I have some contacts with direct sources, and that's where I'm trying to keep most of my information for that. I'm just starting that right now.
So you can see that everybody here wants to make comics, just like Siegel and Shuster. They're interested in making comics. They're not necessarily in it to make the $2 billion that, you know, theoretically you can still make, but it's getting extremely unlikely. And they've gotten in a wide variety of ways. Andrew, can you explain to people really fast what a mini comic is and how you make it? Because I think probably 2/3 of the audience may never have seen a mini comic.
A mini comic is essentially just, I think it's about 5 by 8 inches.
Letter paper folded.
Yeah, it's essentially just letter paper folded in half.
Xerox it?
Yeah, you can Xerox it. There are some good printers now where you can kind of submit, you know, your files through a website, and then they, you know, send you 50 or 100 copies or whatever you want. But it's essentially just a really small comic, and it can be anywhere from, you know, 4 to 25 pages or whatever.
So in some ways it has a lot in common with an artist's book. There's no real mediation between you and the creator, and they can be as fancy as you want. I've seen die cut ones before.
We're now doing the Magic Bullet, which is printed on newsprint. We also did a number of anthologies through print on demand and like in a more perfect bound sort of structure. But our earliest anthology, the DC Conspiracy, did when we started, were all mini comics. And we would send them out to a press. They were in New York? In upstate New York? Yep. In upstate New York, and we would send them the files, and they would just print them out. on paper, and they'd send them to us, and then we'd all sit around the bar that we met at and fold and staple them, like, each issue ourselves to sell. And so that was, I mean, I think that's some of the enjoyment of mini comics, especially for people who are really into comics, is you get these from the creators, and they're something that a lot of times they've folded and stapled themselves. And I've gotten mini comics that are die cut like that, and you can tell when looking at the other ones that they die cut them themselves. They sat down with their X-Acto and they cut out the little shape on the cover of every single one and then put it out. And so it's really, I don't know, it's kind of, it's really a substantial piece of something that the artist created in many aspects of it.
And oddly enough, Washington, D.C. is actually a center for these types of things, because for, I don't know, well over a decade and a half, there's been a small press expo that's been held here in town, although it's migrating up to what they like to call Upper North Bethesda now. It's been in North Bethesda, which everybody else calls Rockville, for 3 years. But right, there's a pretty much small press means that the people that come write and produce their own comics, and you can meet, I think there's like 250 tables probably this year, something like that. They expanded it this year. So that's in the fall, in September, and the Post usually runs a little thing announcing it. Does anybody have any questions now that you've got there? Okay, front row, shoot.
Well, first I think I'll mention something that you guys may not have seen, but the Friday issue of Of All Places, the Wall Street Journal, has a very nice article about people who are into comic books and the impact of that on tablets. So if you haven't seen it, it's up on their website.
No, I've not seen that, yeah.
I personally would like to ask Andrew more about how my law school banned your comic books. your comics.
I was at the George Washington University. So I had done kind of, I guess, sort of the cheapest kind of mini comic, which is just one sheet of paper folded in half. You kind of draw a cover on one page. And so it's just kind of a four page, you know, one sheet folded. It was sort of satirizing one of the professors. And it was admittedly,
it was dirty.
It was dirty.
It wasn't pornographic.
It wasn't pornographic, but it was kind of
blue.
It was blue. one of the things I like about kind of comics and mini comics is just like the very disposable aspect of them. You can just kind of print it up, fold it in half, and then just kind of leave it somewhere, or kind of distribute it, you know, however you want. And evidently, somebody didn't like it, and I had to have a conversation with the dean.
Well, you were leaving it around like it, where like the newspapers were.
Right, I was leaving it kind of where they distribute like the student newspapers and the law school newspapers. Just kind of a little stack there, you know, the other flyers for groups. And so I had a conversation with the dean and was informed that I would not be doing that again.
As a law student, didn't you fight back and use the statement of student rights?
I put up some more blue posters telling people where they could pick up the comics.
Well, because he said that was the one thing he said, you could put up a poster.
Right.
Not to keep up with this, but it was, as I recall, when you were telling us the conversation, was just like, he wasn't telling you necessarily that you couldn't do it, but that he would maybe recommend not to, right?
Right.
You know, one of those like lawyerly things about walking that fine line.
I responded to it as a comic book form rather than lawyer form.
Neat. Well, that'll presumably be in the collected work, right? okay, I saw him first, so let's go with the blue shirt and then we'll move over to the white shirt.
While I'm sure you would hope that one day this is a self-supporting occupation, what do you do for your day jobs?
I work for a higher education association, editing their publications.
I work as an art director and graphic designer at an ad agency.
Okay. I'm a freelance designer.
I'm an unemployed lawyer.
I work for the Smithsonian, putting together exhibit cases.
And I'm a medical historian archivist for the federal government. So, okay, second row.
I heard you mention the disposability aspect of a lot of comics. You're also doing some books more substantial, that do you prefer that, to have something that will last versus disposable? And that's to anybody up there. Any preferences?
I think it depends on what type of story you're going to tell. Like if it's just the one page quick thing that you can get out there, that I would just Xerox. But if you had a longer story that you want a nice presentation on, something nice like these books up here, I think that you would take more effort into like a multi-page story. But if it's something that you can just easily fold, like most mini comics, I don't think most mini comics really go over 28 pages. So if it's a quick story that you want it to just get out there and be disposed of, then I would go mini comics route. But you can also collect the mini comics eventually after you have several of them and then make them in a nicer presentation, because then at least it's going to be thick enough to have a spine to actually sit on a shelf.
I think one of the premises behind the Magic Bullet newspaper was we kind of liked that idea of it being kind of disposable. We put it on the newspaper that we felt, well, it's not too expensive to make, and if somebody can pick it up and give it for free, so I think kind of gives us individually exposure as creators, and that was kind of one of the premises behind the DC Conspiracy, which is that comic creators collective. And we all know each other. There's probably a lot of cartoonists in the area, but I think they're all kind of in these different pockets. And I think in the last couple of years, 5 to 7 years, I think we all kind of started to pull together, whether we do our own web comics or comics or editorial comics. And it's been a really kind of fun atmosphere. So one of the things we liked about was this disposability of it. And I think that the more attraction the group gets as a whole is good for us as individual creators, because you get to kind of experience, I like this person's style, I like this person's stories. So it's kind of like this group exposure.
One of the things about disposability, I'll be right with you, ma'am, is that the world is changing as well. Traditionally, as you saw in the play here, comics were disposable. But now one of the biggest aspects of the market is actually collections of like 1930s and 1940s comic strips. And then some people whose work had been collected, and I'm going to say editorial cartoonists, newspapers used to do a collection a year, and that's fading off. So technology keeps changing the world, and it's hard to say where this is going to end up. I would say once you start putting stuff on the web, it never goes away.
So, as long as you keep paying your monthly hosting.
Right. As long as you don't lose power.
Yeah,
yeah, true.
I like the disposability of comics in a way that you don't have anymore. Like as also as they've become more of a collectible item, they've started printing them on nicer paper and with nicer inks, which is nice. You get a nice product, but it's also a much more expensive product, and it's become less of that thing. Like, I'm always a fan of the idea of these comics, like they talked about in the play, how like they sold 2 million comics, and then for every comic, 7 to 10 kids read that same comic, and that was the thing. You could just, it's something you could crumple up, you could shove in your back pocket, you could take anywhere, you pull it out, you read it, you enjoy it, and it like you can kind of hand it off, somebody can get it, you're not worried about like, oh, I gotta get this back, you get that. So then more people get to see these things, and I like collection, like I love being part of a collector. There's nothing nicer than getting a book that you printed, especially like Shock. I got my copy of it. It's a nice hardback book. I put it on my shelf. I'm really proud of it. But there's also something to be said about this thing that I can just like hand to anybody and just be like, just go with it. If you don't, if it doesn't interest you, hand it to somebody else. If you really don't like it, leave it at the bar you're at, and somebody else might pick it up. And
It seems to me that comics and graphics, graphic novels, have the potential to reach people who wouldn't necessarily read regular type of printing. And I'm wondering to what extent there's a major field of using that medium, your medium, for teaching serious issues related to health or education or how civil, discourse, things like that.
Anybody
want to
run with that one?
I think there's definitely a growing interest. I think first thing we have to overcome is this kind of stigma that's still attached to comics, that it's all superheroes or it's all kind of, exaggerated body parts and things like that. There are other types of comics. Art Spiegelman won Pulitzer Prize for Mouse.
Right.
And, that's probably the pinnacle of what you can achieve. I know that the libraries are very interested in it. They're beefing up their graphic novels section. based on that, the whole historical aspect of it, the whole social aspect of it. So there's a lot of potential, and it continues to grow. For the books that I do, they're a lot historically based or nature based, you know, and my big people who buy my books are the libraries, so that's my bread and butter. Not so much comic book stores.
I will say, to address that, one of the creators who's a contemporary of Siegel and Schuster was a man named Will Eisner, and he used to do a newspaper comic strip called The Spirit, and he packed that in to go to work for doing writing comics to explain how he worked in the U.S. Army, how you repair tanks and stuff like that. He formed a company and did a comic book called P.S. for, let's see, 40 years before he handed it off to somebody else. So there's a strong tradition of doing educational comics, but most people don't have as much talent as Will Eisner, and they're really pretty boring, generally speaking. But on the other hand, there's a lot of graphic novels, or there's no other good term for it now. Graphic novels is a marketing term, but there are a lot of things that you can go into a store like Barnes & Noble's and find. There's a manga Shakespeare series and stuff like that. So sometimes they do them on the cheap and you get so-so art, but it is widening. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, and then we had a question here. A
couple of things. Number one, there's actually a thing where you read a book and you leave it somewhere and somebody picks it up and they track these books of where they've gone. I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I don't remember the name either. But yeah, that would be kind of fun to do, actually.
But I mean, real books, okay? The other thing is that I was going to ask you that in many ways, comics are coming back, like because of the graphic novels and the Japan, and were you surprised about that? And the other thing is, I live in Baltimore. Is there any way that I can get a magic bullet?
Okay, so we got two questions there. One, can she get a magic bullet? Sure, that's no problem. I mean,
I've got some copies.
Right, and when it comes out, we will let people know.
Yeah, we try to literally just blanket the area with them. We, you know, all the creators kind of take on responsibility of also distributing it where they can. So whether it's a comic book shop or a book shop or coffee shop or whatever it is, if we go on a trip to a convention, we bring them with us. So
I think there's also a map online that we have where they're documented, where the actual locations you can pick up.
Well, I'm just saying. Okay. But and in response to you, I remember reading famous stories in comic books.
Classic comics.
It might be the same sort of thing of everything old is new again.
Yes, and some of those are in fact being reprinted as standalone thin hardcover books for the library market that Matt mentioned. You had asked about the return of comic books, which is sort of a weird thing because in some ways comic books are not very healthy these days. Anybody want to touch on that? Steve, you used to do a regular comic book and you've drawn Star Trek for DC most recently.
Mm-hmm. Well, nothing's really healthy right now. So we're a pretty fragile little ecosystem. I think if you run out of disposable income, comics probably one of the first things you might stop buying. If there is a resurgence, it's online, I tend to think, because right now the mini comics in a lot of ways have gone online, not entirely, but the idea is that you don't even have to pay for printing. You don't have to worry about it. You can just put your work online and everybody can see it. And so now that coupled with rising costs of printing, because paper pulp is generally more expensive now than it was 15 years ago, and the rise of print on demand. So if you were doing comics 15 years ago and you wanted to print a comic book like Superman yourself, you'd have to print 3,000 of the minimum. And that's when you're talking about Superman numbers of 2 million, but that kind of network to distribute books doesn't exist anymore for comics. I mean, there are still newsstands, but there are so many fewer ones. There are fewer bookstores. I mean, just that whole kind of mass market distribution of comics just isn't in place anymore. I mean, if any, it might be growing a little bit. I mean, I have seen a little bit more in toy stores and things like that, but that's probably a bigger part of Disney having bought Marvel, things like that, you know, so.
Yeah. A lot of times the companies pay for placement. I'll be right with you, ma'am. Another thing, too, the play alluded to this, that as Superman kept going on, he changed his powers and stuff like that. I'm losing track of this thought here. I'm just going to drop that one. Maybe I'll come back to it. Let's take the question right over there. Yep, you.
All right. Yes, I'm a cross-dresser, now you know.
Sorry, I took my glasses off.
We call this Metropolis High School cheerleader because it's too hot to wear the suit. But anyway, you all have definitely touched on the technology part of this. I'm a freelance music journalist, and you know the technology thing is really affecting that area. And we're all, I mean, now we all have to call ourselves quote-unquote content providers. And it is really hard for me to sort through. I mean, I never made a living at it because my taste in music is very off-center, mm-hmm. but I used to at least be able to get paid for it. And now, you know, figuring that out is even hard. And I would imagine it's just as hard for you guys. And I just want to make that observation about how technology is really affecting the journalism, comics, music, writing in general, all of this. And it's, you know, the public or the younger public, it appears to me, is getting used to the idea that they don't have to pay for cultural work, that then they can share files and all of this, and it's just going to get harder and harder for us to get paid unless maybe we do something really special. Like, I have a little toe in this business because the artist Charles Vess mm-hmm. did a thing called ballads, and that was comic book adaptations of traditional British folk ballads. I'm a specialist. I like British folk rock. I did discography notes for that, which meant okay. I looked up imprint recordings of the ballads, listed those, and did short bios of the performers who recorded them. Mm-hmm. But that's like a special thing, and one of the things I used to talk about was producing a CD of new recordings of those ballads to go with it. I haven't managed to do that yet. Money, of course. But, you know, I'm wondering about this. I'm wondering if box sets, which is a special thing in the music business, are there, I mean, maybe there are equivalents in the comic book thing that would be a special event that people would go out by, not just a repackaging of the DC's Crisis on Infinite Earths meets the zombies, I forget what the damn thing was called, the Darkest Night, not just repackaging those things, but just something that really would be special.
What I have seen, and what these guys have made a success of with DC Conspiracy, is Kickstarter. One of the biggest Kickstarter things has been a webcomic, which raised over $1 million. The guy has to pay taxes on it, but he wasn't remotely expecting that. And a contemporary of Charles Vess is Pete Craig Russell. He's put out one DVD on how he draws his comics, and he writes about opera. He draws comics about opera.
Right.
And he's crowdsourcing his second one about how he draws his comics right now. And that's one that I chose to fund because I'm interested in that. So, I mean, the mechanisms are changing, and it's hard to say where they will shake out. You guys have funded each of the Magic Bullets different ways, right? All five issues were funded differently, and now we're going back to Kickstarter the second time.
It's all our money.
Yeah, okay.
We each contributed a portion.
Entrepreneurs, and we weren't.
Yes, it does. And cartoonists and artists don't necessarily do great with that. But
another thing to add to that is also a lot of us exhibit at the conventions, like, you know, Baltimore mm-hmm. Comic Con, etc. Small Press Expo, like was mentioned earlier. And I feel like just exhibiting and being a creator, it's good to have different price points. Like, you'll have small things like the mini comics might only be $1 or $2. And then you'll have something bigger that would be a collected volume. So then that way you can reach all different type of people. Somebody might only have $1, they might really like your stuff and be willing to spend that dollar on the mini comic. And some people might like your stuff to a higher extent and be willing to buy your collected volume. So I think it's good as a creator to have different levels, like you were saying, the box set, like, and then just a regular CD.
To get away from this, you know, mm-hmm. my fear is that everything's going to go completely digital, and I am not comfortable with that.
I think everybody has like a little edge on it, but no one really knows where the future exactly is headed. But even with like web comics, like pretty much all of them are for free, so it's you kind of can't really take a step back to be like, oh, now I'm going to charge. If you want to look at my work, but there are ways to do it, like even like archives, like. You know, maybe there's a way that you can have them all be in an app and somebody might pay, whatever, $1.99 for the app and then you get extra content. There's clever ways to figure out how to make money once you build your fan base. But the main thing is, like, you really have to build your fan base first in order to make that money. And that's hard to do, too. It's not easy.
Did you want to follow up, Evan? Or?
No, I mean, I was just saying that, like, a lot of that, like, the webcomics are free. And so, like, a lot of people do become entrepreneurs and make... Like, anybody that I've ever heard about making money off of comics doing a webcomic has made all their money selling t-shirts and mouse pads and, you know, collections and other kind of ephemera that aren't necessarily their comic. They're not necessarily, but it's the name. They put it out there, they became popular, and their name's out there, and so then they sell other things that are connected to it, and that's how they make their money. But it's
which
still,
is true of comics as well. I mean, a lot of the Superman money has never been the comic book. It's all the merchandising they talked about. And getting back to the point was, you were talking about comic books being, asking about comic books being successful, and I was trying to say that DC rebooted Superman again this year and scraped away everything and had him running around in a t-shirt because they want to get new readers in again. They're once again worried about bringing in the children as opposed to the 40-year-olds, the 50-year-olds, that, you know.
That is younger.
Yeah, they need the younger people to keep buying comics. Although, with they're more tightly tied in with Time Warner now. They brought in a movie exec to run the comic book company, and Marvel, the other big company, was bought by Disney last year. So there's some thought that these things are just basically existing to be a cheap idea farm for the movies.
Well, but there's also, like, there's been a bigger push now, like, also relating back to the play about how they lost their creation. There's been a push recent, like, there's been a lot of news recently about high-profile creators leaving the companies and just to do creator-owned work. They're more interested in getting published by somebody where they create their own stuff, and not as many creators are staying with the big companies, Marvel and DC, and creating characters for them because there's no profit in them for it. So they can make their name at Marvel and DC writing these characters like Superman or Batman that somebody else created, and they can do some work on that, and then they can move on to try to make their mark by doing something of their own.
It goes both directions, because as one of those people approaching 50, I've seen that since the 1980s.
Well, yeah, no, it's done that. It's been going for a long time,
right.
But it's just
a lot of people
are less interested in coming to one of those companies and be like, I got this great character, here you go.
Yeah.
And things like Kickstarter and the internet have made it so that you feel like there's more of an avenue for you to go out on your own if you want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did I see another hand raised? The director.
I just want to throw out, this is less a question than an observation. It's really interesting, there's this constant conversation as theater makers in DC that you get this reaction from people when you meet them out of like, you make theater, you're a director, you're an actor, you're a playwright in DC. And you can sort of get a chip on your shoulder after hearing that too many times, although many of the artists who are here because they actually don't want to be in New York or don't want to be in LA. I guess I wonder if you get the same kind of reactions, or is there a city that it's expected that comic artists are going to live in this city? Or is it less geographically centered in one place?
I'd say like there's a lot of cities that I know cartoonists live in, like specifically Brooklyn or Portland. Like that seems to be a big hub. But the DC area, like more and more I come out, I keep meeting more and more cartoonists every like 6 months even. Like I'm like, oh wait, what? Who are you? Like and then I realize all their body of work and I keep discovering people all the time. So that's pretty amazing. I've been around here for a long time and I still keep finding new cartoonists that keep emerging, and some of them have been around for a really long time and I don't know where I've been, but yeah, I just keep meeting them. But as far as like being a cartoonist in DC or any city with the internet again now, it doesn't really matter where you necessarily live, but a lot of cartoonists tend to live in like lower income cultural cities.
One thing I've noticed about when you tell people that you're in DC and you do comics is they immediately assume you're a political cartoonist, that you work for a newspaper or something like that, doing op-ed pieces. And when you don't do anything like that, it's kind of to explain that it's not what you think.
Yeah, I think it was New York. Everything was in New York up until FedEx, you know,
right.
And then it started spreading out everywhere.
So, right, so Portland and Brooklyn are basically just because people kind of wanted to live there and gravitate to each other.
Well, the people in Portland used to live in San Francisco, and they moved to Portland because it was cheaper. And now you have, like, some of the publishers up in the Portland area, so they kind of congregate. You know, I think what happens, and you have these clusters, and they're kind of growing, like Columbus, Ohio has a nice cluster of cartoonists. You might not expect, and you have to kind of look for it a little bit. But I think with the internet, we all can kind of connect a lot easier. Like, I know where these folks are, and we can say, let's get together, let's do this. So actually, what I think is going to happen is you're going to see more regionalization of comics and comic shows. For example, Small Press Expo, I think it's like $400 to get a table there for the weekend. Maybe, you know, depending on what industry you're in, that might seem much, but if you're selling mini comics at $2 a pop, it takes a lot of mini comics to get the table back. Right. So that means that folks from Ohio, when they come over here, they have to pay for the table, their, you know, a hotel and all this stuff, so they might not come here. Same thing with New York. One of the reasons I don't go to some of the New York shows is it's just too expensive for me. So.
And we have a couple other cartoonists here, too. In the front row, Steve Bartley is a political cartoonist and the son of a political cartoonist. And so he's seen some changes in the area. There's less political cartoonists here than there used to be, right?
No, much less. I feel myself fading away every day.
It's still a substantial
just like newsprint.
And let me put my glasses on just to confirm. Yes, that is Jim Dugan sitting back there. Jim is another DC conspiracy type who does a webcomic with a group of people in Brooklyn. Right? I mean, Activate.
By happenstance more than anything else that I'm connected to a sort of collective of people that's centered in Brooklyn, although has people living all over the world who do it. But I'm a writer, so. Mm-hmm.
And you're retelling Samson's story, speaking of the Superman play.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. That's probably one, that's one way to refer to it. It's a webcomic called Sam and Lila, which is maybe not a retelling, but
a supernatural love story.
Yes,
with
supernatural love story
super
that
strength.
Borrows heavily from Samson and Delilah.
Yes, and has DC United.
That's right.
So, anybody else have any questions? I notice we're getting on towards 6, so it's probably getting about time to wrap this one up. There are copies of Magic Bullet here.
Right. And I don't know if anyone else brought some stuff, but I can leave some stuff here if you want to look. Some of these books aren't out yet, but they're going to be out in the next month or two. So you can feel free and just take a look at it if you would.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.